appreciate Ryan reading from Matthew's account of the events we're going to be looking at this evening as we continue through this tour of Galilee that Jesus and the apostles are on. Last week we looked at Jesus giving the instruction to the 12 and sending them out on what's often called the limited commission, as he sent them out not to all the world or to every creature, but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And so you had seven teams, you might say, going out, or six teams plus Jesus going out, going different directions throughout Galilee and preaching and teaching. And so as we saw in the text that Ryan read a few moments ago, it's about King Herod and the events of that surround John the Baptist and a misperception about who Jesus was. As we've noted in previous lessons, Galilee was ruled by King Herod. And if you remember from earlier text, you had Herod the Great, who was the Herod whenever Jesus was born. He was the one that had the babies in Bethlehem killed. And then Jesus and his family, Joseph, takes the family and they go down into Egypt. And then King Herod the Great dies, and his kingdom, so to speak, is divided among his four sons. And so these are kind of puppet leaders in many ways, because they were all under Roman rule at this point. But yet these Herods did still have a lot of power that they wielded. Well, this particular Herod would be Herod Antipas. And he was the one that was in charge over Galilee as well as some other areas. But prior to Jesus sending out the 12 on this limited commission, King Herod had evidently paid little attention to the work of Jesus. And Jesus is becoming more popular, and there's multitudes of people are following him from place to place. But as a rule, as long as a peasant reformer, which is kind of what Jesus would have been considered, as long as those type people didn't stir up the masses to rebellion, the government was not overly concerned about them. But now that we have seven teams of evangelists crisscrossing his territory, Herod can no longer ignore this new movement. And so he's taking an interest now in Jesus. And so first of all, we see Herod's mistaken view of Jesus. And we're going to be looking, Ryan read for us from Matthew's account. We're going to be following, as far as our text in the lesson, Mark's account. And so that's in Mark chapter 6, verses 14 through verse 29. So that's primarily where we'll stay if you want to turn there in your Bible. And so Mark 6, beginning in verse 14, and we'll bring in some words from the other versions. But it says, "Now at that time," Matthew says, "King Herod, the Tetrarch, heard of him," talking about Jesus, "for his name had become well known." Luke tells us that he was perplexed when he heard these things. And he said, Matthew also says that he said, Luke says it was said by some, Herod, it seems, would say, "John the Baptist is risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him." What powers? The powers that Jesus is doing, the signs and wonders and miracles that Jesus is doing, these must be from John the Baptist risen from the dead. Verse 15, "Others said it is Elijah, and others said it is the prophet, or like one of the prophets." Notice it says of the prophet. Remember, Moses talked about a prophet, the prophet that would come likened to him. And so that's a reference to him. Or he says, like one of the prophets. Verse 16, "But when Herod heard, he said, 'This is John whom I beheaded. He has been raised from the dead.'" And then Luke says, "So he sought to see him." And so he's seeking an audience with Jesus. He's wanting to see him because he has come to the conclusion that Jesus is really John the Baptist raised from the dead. And so you kind of put the accounts together, and Matthew's account says, "At that time Herod the Tetrarch heard the report about Jesus." In Mark's account, after a summary of the work of the 12 in chapter 6, verse 13, he says, "Now King Herod heard of him for his name had become well known. And then Luke wrote about the success of the apostles as well, Luke 9, verse 6. And then he says in verse 7 that now Herod the Tetrarch heard all that was done by him, and he was perplexed. And so the news is coming. As Jesus is growing in his popularity, and the 12 have now gone out, and they're having an impact upon Galilee, news is coming to Herod. And so word reaches Herod's ears about what the people are saying about Jesus. Some are saying he's Elijah, others that he's one of the prophets that have risen from the dead. The Jews didn't think of Jesus as the Messiah. Notice that's not even one of the options that they're considering. They don't think he's the Messiah because they expected the Messiah to come with pomp and circumstance. The Messiah is supposed to come in with fanfare and the trumpets blowing and riding on the white horse and everybody bowing down to him and all of those things. That's their expectation. And so they don't even consider that he's the Messiah, but they do concede that he might be a prophet. You know, through the years, men have consistently fallen short in their estimation of Jesus. Many today will concede the same thing. They won't concede that he's the Son of God, that he's the Christ, but they'll say, oh, he was a good man, he was a good teacher, he was a prophet even. But they sell him fall short of who he really was. The Jewish populace followed the Pharisees, believed in resurrection. And so their theology of resurrection was mixed with a lot of superstition. They believed in what we today might call reincarnation. They believed that the spirits of dead people would come back in another person. And so a dead person's spirit could come and they could basically fill and empower a living person. They could basically take over a living person's body. And that's how many accounted for Jesus' miraculous power, that he must be one of these prophets. He must be John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, or some of them. And that came about Herod. He's going to follow that same supposition. He believes the same thing and comes to the conclusion then that Jesus is indeed John, risen from the dead. Now, you study about Herod's family, and Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us a lot about the things of Herod's family and so forth, besides what we read about in the Bible. And, you know, you watch some of these movies or TV shows about some of these ruthless kings back in medieval times and so forth. And this story that Ryan read for us a few moments ago almost sounds like the script from one of them, doesn't it? Just this ruthless person and this woman that's asking for the head of somebody brought in on a platter and presented to them and all of those type things. But that was the Herod family. The Herod family was characterized by masterful political maneuvers and by turbulent family relations. Some of the Herods even had many of their own family members killed because they considered them a threat to their power. That the family was plagued by sexual scandals, especially incest and divorce and so forth. And they had adopted the Jewish religion, at least as far as it was convenient for their purposes. You know, and that fits a lot of people today, doesn't it? A lot of people are just as religious as it's convenient for them to be, and that's the way the Herods were. Politically, they adopted the views of the Sadducees, but they got their faith from the Pharisees. And both of those were for pragmatic reasons, because they were kind of trying to keep a foot in each camp. They increased their realm of influence by being on the good side of both the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Herod the Tetrarch, also called king in the text here, again, he was the son of Herod the Great through his Samaritan wife, Malthrace. And like the other Herods, he has enough conscience to plague him with the guilt for his misdeeds, but not enough to overcome his unquenchable appetite for political power. And so as he does these ruthless, evil things that he does, his conscience bothers him some, and he tries to appease that with some religious things, but really there's not much there. He's in the uncomfortable position of a corrupt politician who just dabbles in religion, like, again, some of our politicians even today. His guilt causes him to ponder who Jesus is. He's wondering about this. Who is this man? He's certainly not ready to go and become a disciple of Jesus, a follower of Christ, but he does at least wonder. He has a curiosity about him. But what made the king the most nervous was the fact that some were saying John the Baptist is risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him. You know, these people that were saying this, they evidently did not know that Jesus and John had their ministries at the same time. You know, their ministries had overlapped a lot. And so they evidently didn't know that. And again, ignorance is often hindered men in their, or never hindered men, you might say, in their speculation. The talk made the tetrarch nervous because he had beheaded John not long before. You know, I guess if you've beheaded someone and then you think they've risen from the dead, that would make you nervous, because you'd probably be the first on their revenge list. And so he's nervous. Matthew 14:13 goes on and talks about when Jesus heard of John's death, he withdrew across the Sea of Galilee, and that's where he feeds the 5,000. We'll look at that next week. Mark 6 goes on and talks about that shortly after his disciples returned from their tour of Galilee, that they withdrew to the other side of the sea. And you know, if you kind of compare the accounts, it seems that John was killed while Jesus and his disciples are out making this third tour of Galilee. And then the news reaches Jesus at the end of that tour. And so the misconceived view of Jesus is that this is John the Baptist who has come back from the dead. And then the rest of the text goes on and talks about the imprisonment and the execution of John. Herod had indeed had him beheaded, and so here's how that unfolds. Again, continuing in our text then in Mark, picking up with verse 17 of chapter 6, "For Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. Because John had said to Herod, 'It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife.'" Luke's account says, "being rebuked by him concerning Herodias." Verse 19, "Therefore Herodias held it against him and wanted to kill him, but she could not. For Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly." Now Matthew chapter 14 and verse 5 says, "And although he wanted to put him to death, he feared the multitude because he counted him as a prophet." You know, that's a little bit different than what Mark says. Mark, you know, he feared him and he's kind of protecting him. Matthew brings out a point that, you know, maybe he really wanted to put him to death, but he's holding off because he feared the multitudes, because they counted him as a prophet. But Herod had imprisoned John a year or so earlier, and he did that, of course, to appease his wife, Herodias. The king had lured Herodias, who was his half-brother Philip's wife, away from Philip, and he had married her, Matthew 14 and verse 3. Herodias herself was also a descendant of Herod the Great. She was actually Herod Antipas' half-niece. And so her marriage to Herod Antipas had broke a number of the Levitical laws. The law condemned marriage to a near relative, which she would have been, Leviticus chapters 18 and chapter 20. It also prohibited a man from marrying his brother's wife while his brother was still living, Leviticus 18:16, Deuteronomy 25 verses 5 through 10. John had thus told Herod it is not lawful for you to have her. He now has Herodias as his wife. She had been his brother Philip's wife, but now he has taken her as his wife, and John says it is not lawful for you to have her. Well, that infuriated Herodias, Mark 6 and verse 19. You know, we don't know exactly when or how John delivered that message to Herod, but we do know the result of it, because that's what the text focuses on, is the result. John the Baptist was certainly never accused of being soft-spoken. You go back to the prophecies about him in Isaiah 40, verses 3 through 5. The prediction is not that he will be soft-spoken. You see him coming, Matthew chapter 3, verses 7 through 12, and he was not soft-spoken. He's a very outspoken, forceful individual. The problem is described by Josephus in the Antiquities of the Jews, his writing. It tells of Herod's first wife. She was the daughter of Aretas, the king of Arabia. And after they had been married for a few years, Herod had taken a trip to Rome. And while he was there, he stayed with his half-brother Philip. And Herod fell in love with Philip's wife, Herodias. And he repaid his brother's hospitality by convincing Herodias to divorce Philip and to come away with him and to marry him. But when they get back home, his first wife, Aretas' daughter, catches wind of what has happened, and so she goes to Herod, not telling him that she knows what has happened, but she convinces him to let her take a little trip to Machaerus, which bordered her father's territory, and he grants her that, and she goes to Machaerus, and then she's easily able to escape from there over to her father. Well, Aretas, the king of Arabia, he's angry, and so he declared war on Herod. And eventually he destroyed Herod's army, and he would have completely destroyed Herod had not the Roman general Vitellius stepped in and interceded on Herod's behalf. This marriage, again, was illegal for several reasons. Herod's first wife is still living. Again, you have the idea of Herod, she belonged to his brother, his half-brother Philip. She's his niece. And Philip's niece as well, so really neither one of them should have ever had him, Herodias, as a wife. It was an incestuous relationship. But Josephus gives a couple of other reasons that came into play as well, probably, as far as Herod arresting John. Secondly, he talks about John's popularity. As John's popularity grew, so did the unrest of the people. And so it was the stuff that rebellions are made of. And thus Herod, fearing a public revolt, he took out the key player of the opposition, which would have been John. Many of the people of Herod Philip's tetrarchy and Trachonitis went over to fight with Aretas against Herod Antipas, understandably so. And so the bulk of John's preaching was in the north Judea and in Turia, which is very close to Trachonitis. And so it was, you know, lest the people followed after their lead of the northern countrymen, Herod takes this rabble-rouser out of the picture. And then a third possibility that Josephus presents is that typically the Herods aligned with the Sadducees and control of the temple precincts, but again, they also aligned with the Pharisees, who were continually rising in their popularity. And so to arrest John would be very well received among the Pharisees, because they rejected John. They hated John almost as much as they hated Jesus. And so it was an opportunity to make some very important friends. And so probably several things that are involved in Jesus or in Herod arresting John, but principal among them this point that John has told him that he could not have Herodias as a wife. But not only is Herod annoyed with John, but even more so Herodias is annoyed. And so you have a woman that scorned, so to speak, and she's not going to take this lightly. And so she tries to persuade Herod to kill John, but two things stand in the way. First of all, Herod was reluctant to go that far because he fears that the death of John, who the people consider a prophet, might result in an uprising. Matthew 14, verse 5. The populace, again, they believe that John was a prophet, and they're already upset because he's even arrested John. And so Herod has to kind of walk on eggshells, you might say, in order to not push the public over the edge into to open rebellion. But a second thing was that Herod seemed to hold this grudging respect for John, knowing that he was indeed a righteous man. Again, Mark wrote in Mark 6, verse 20, that Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And then he adds, and when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. I like the translation in the New American Standard better. It says, when he heard him, he was very perplexed, but he used to enjoy listening to him. And so even though the things that John told him were unsettling, it seemed that Herod had some respect for John, and he liked listening to the things that John had to say to him. You know, we can kind of picture in our mind's eye, what did John look like? John in his rough clothes, you know, this a lot like the prophet Elijah, this camel hair and so forth. And as he's quite a sight as he stands before Herod. Herod is used to the royal finery and so forth. But a troubled look must have crossed King Herod's face as the prophet shook a finger in his direction and said, it is not lawful for you to have her. The Living Bible paraphrase puts it this way. It says, Herod was disturbed whenever he talked with John, but even so, he liked listening to it. And so he has that respect for John. According to Josephus, again, John was held at Machaerus. That was a 2,360-foot mountain fortress that was at the north end of the Dead Sea. It was second in strength only to Jerusalem itself. And Josephus also says that that was where Aretas' daughter, Herod's first wife, fled when she discovered Herod's scheme with Herodias. Well, you might notice in Mark's account, Mark, of course, is the briefest of the gospel accounts, only 16 chapters long. Some places it spends more time, like it did with the instructions to the 12. But Mark only devotes 3 verses to John's ministry. By far the least of the gospel accounts, but he devotes 13 to John's death. And that seems to suggest that John's ministry is a precursor not only to John's ministry is a precursor to Jesus' ministry, but also that John's death is a precursor of Jesus' death. Mark puts a lot of emphasis on that death. Look back at the text then, pick back up in verse 21. Then an opportune day came when Herod on his birthday gave a feast for his nobles, the high officers, and the chief men of Galilee. And when Herodias' daughter herself came in and danced and pleased Herod and those who sat with him, the king said to the girl, Ask me whatever you want and I will give it to you. He also swore to her, whatever you ask me, I will give you up to half my kingdom. So she went out and said to her mother, what shall I ask? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. Immediately she came in with haste to the king and asked, saying, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. So Herod had managed to protect John from Herodias until this fateful day when the king decided to give a birthday party for himself. And he invites all of the nobles, all of his cronies, so to speak. And, you know, general accounts of pagan banquets of that day, plus a knowledge of the moral standards of the Herods, gives us a pretty good picture of what kind of banquet this is, what kind of party this is. It's a drunken orgy. And so at the height of the orgy, Herod's daughter, or Herodias' daughter, Herod's stepdaughter, came into the banquet room to dance. Josephus tells us the name of the girl, that it's Salome. And the text doesn't say, per se, that this is a sensuous dance. But again, as you look at the situation and you consider the Oriental culture, it certainly very much is suggested. And, you know, besides that, Herod doesn't offer half of his kingdom just for some good choreography. There's something more to it than that. And, you know, what makes this even more disgusting, as this girl dances what is very obvious, a very sensual, sexual dance. You know, she's a stepdaughter. But even further than that, she's probably only about 12 years old. The word that's used, that Mark uses there in verse 22, that's translated girl, charesion, means little girl or young girl. It doesn't mean a woman. It doesn't mean like a teenage girl, but a younger girl. It's the word that's used in Matthew 9, verse 24, when it talks about Jairus' daughter. And the text there tells us that she was 12 years old. So this girl is probably about that same age. And so this is just, it's sick on every front that you can look at it. But Mark 6:21 says that an opportune day came. And so Herodias has been trying to get this done. She wants John put to death. Herod has been holding her off, protecting him as best he can, but now an opportune day came. And the opportune day is orchestrated by Herod, in a sense, in that it's his birthday and he throws this big drunken party. But the opportune is really Herodias' strategy. Her daughter's dance was part of that strategy. Herodias knew her lustful husband very well. She knew what would get his attention. And the fact that Herodias would use her daughter in such a way is, you know, to further her cruel plans, plus the fact that the king would allow his stepdaughter to exhibit herself in such a manner before his drunken companions reveals again much about the character of the Herods, of this kingly family. You know, we might wonder, well, why would a little girl do such a thing as this? Why would she go in and dance in this way? And verse 24 tells us it was her mother put her up to it. It was her mother's plan. It wasn't her plan. And so, as vile as it was, such was the nature of the Herod family. Their corruption was worsened by their shrewdness, their scheming that they did. And so the text tells us that Salome's dance pleased Herod and those who sat with him. Mark 6, verse 22. He's pleased by what he sees. As he sees his, again, this underage stepdaughter of his dancing in this way. And he tells the girl, "Ask me whatever you want and I will give it to you." And then he even swears with an oath, "Whatever you ask me, I will give you up to half my kingdom." Now, you might notice, you read texts like that several times in the Bible, where a king will make that type of a statement. And such extravagant offers were typical of Eastern rulers. What was not expected was that you took them up on their offer. In fact, they would look very unkindly to anyone who actually took them up. It was just a boasting that they did. It was something they said. They were not really expecting anyone. Everybody knew better than to actually take them up on an offer of taking up to half of their kingdom when they offered that. But Salome doesn't hesitate. The text says, having been prompted by her mother. Again, it's her mother's scheme to have John the Baptist killed, and so she asked for the head of John the Baptist on a platter. That boggles my mind. Anybody that would ask for such a thing, let alone a young girl, to ask for such a thing. But notice she wants the head. Herodias, she doesn't want John to be killed and then somebody come back and say, yes, he was killed. She doesn't want just the story of his death, because that could be faked. She doesn't want to see his body laying out in death, because a death scene can be staged. But Herodias is not going to be satisfied with anything other than the detached head of John the Baptist, with the lifeblood draining from the severed veins on a platter in front of her. And not only does she want that, but she wants it at once. She wants it immediately. She wants it before Herod has a chance to change his mind and to come up with some way of getting out of this. You might notice Matthew's account leaves the impression that Herodias had previously coached Salome regarding this, having prompted by her mother. Mark's account indicates that Salome has to go and ask her mother after the offer is made by Herod. Again, the exact order of the events is unimportant, but it's certainly possible that Salome's asking her mother is kind of a bit of the play acting, so to speak, to avoid the appearance that this has been prearranged. Maybe she knows exactly what to ask for, but she gives the pretense of going and asking her mother so that it looks better. Go back to the text, Mark 6, beginning in verse 26. It says, "And the king was exceedingly sorry, yet because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he did not want to refuse her. Immediately the king sent an executioner and commanded his head to be brought. And he went and beheaded him in prison, brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. When his disciples heard of it, they came and took away his corpse and laid it in a tomb." And then Matthew tells us they went and told Jesus. And so when the request is made, Herod is probably drunk at this point. He's boasting. He's trying to sound big in front of his counterparts. And he makes this big offer to this girl. But then when the request was made, he's immediately sorry. He's sorry for what he's offered. He's sorry for the vow that he's made. But he can't lose face, or at least he thinks he can, in front of his counterparts, those who have witnessed his vow. And so he orders John to be beheaded. And the deed is done quickly. And so the act, it may have made Herodias happy. In fact, Josephus tells us that not only when the head of John was brought, that Herodias actually took it back to her chambers and pulled out the tongue and put a big pin through the tongue, making some statement about that tongue would never speak again. She may have been thrilled, but it doesn't seem that Herod has much peace of mind. He's exceedingly sorry. He's grieved by what he's done. Herod doesn't exhibit much of a conscience, but he is at least exceedingly uneasy about these things. And so thus, when he heard the superstitious speculation of the people that Jesus must be John, he must be John the Baptist that is risen from the dead, then he's filled with a sense of fear. Mark records that he said, and really I like the New American Standard wording there better, because it brings out the aspect of the Greek. He kept saying. In the Greek, it has the notion that this is not something he said once, but something he kept saying. This is something that's heavy on his mind. He's saying, "This is John whom I beheaded. He has been raised from the dead." Herod is extremely concerned about what he has done and the fact that this might be John who has come back now to haunt him, and so to speak. Well, Herod decided then that he needed to see Jesus to satisfy his mind regarding whether or not he really was John. Now, he had spent enough time with John, it seems in these discussions maybe that they had, that he felt that he would know if it was John or not. Luke wrote that he sought to see him, Luke 9 and verse 9. Or that the New American Standard says he kept trying to see him. Yeah, that's kind of interesting in itself, because Herod, as the king, had abundant resources at his disposal. One with a public ministry like Jesus that was out and about certainly would not seem that they would be very hard to find, especially for a king to find. And so if he was seeking to see him, it would seem that he would have had fairly easy access to do that. But we learn later in Jesus' ministry, actually at the event of Jesus' trials and his ultimate death, that Herod's quest to see Jesus had never been satisfied, but it also did not fade. During that set of trials, Luke 23 and verse 8, we read that King Herod had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. And so at that point of Jesus' trials, Herod is still seeking an audience with Jesus. Of course, he gets that whenever Pilate sends Jesus over to Herod to kind of try to wash his hands and pawn him off on somebody else. But at any point that Herod had the opportunity to speak with Jesus, Herod again was in a powerful position. Yes, he was subject and under the law of the Romans, but he did have much power, and he had the power to have someone executed. And so at any point that Jesus had stood before Herod after interrogating Jesus, Herod would have had the opportunity and the power to sentence him to death if he so chose. You know, consider again how his father Herod the Great had reacted upon learning of the birth of Jesus, having all of the babies there in Bethlehem killed. And so the king's interest in Jesus' work was a real and imminent threat to Jesus' ministry. Jesus' time had not yet come. Well, just to kind of finish out the story, again, some things that Josephus tells us and other historians, Herodias will ultimately bring about Herod's demise. Part of it comes from the events we're reading about here. The murder of John the Baptist plagued Herod personally and appalled the public. They turned the public against him, and his conscience mingled with the Jewish superstition, made him think that John had risen from the dead. The people were incensed and about the murder of John, who they again knew as a just man and a prophet. And so that was the first step, you might say, of Herod's demise. But his marriage again to Herodias was at the cost of the divorce of his first wife, again the daughter of Aretas, the king of Arabia, and so it led to this war between Arabia and Herod, and Herod saved only by the Roman leader Vitalis. And so the people saw this as God's judgment for the murder of John, and this war put Herod not only on the outs with the Jewish people, but also on the outs with Rome. And finally, over time, and of course this is after the death of Jesus, but finally Herodias, as she's very ambitious for power, she persuaded Herod to go to Rome to seek greater political favor. She wants him to be able to step up to some more important position, but it doesn't work that way. Whenever Herod got to Rome, he was stripped of his dominion and he was banished to lions and Gaul. And so his power is stripped away from him. And Herodias is actually offered a position and offered fortunes by the emperor, but she refuses those and she chooses to go to Gaul with her husband. Maybe the only redeeming incident in her biography. And so that's kind of the end of Herod. But John's remaining disciples, the text tells us, they're going to travel that 80 to 90 miles back up to Galilee where Jesus is at, and deliver this sad report to him. And we might wonder, well, why did John's disciples hang on to John so long? John himself had told them to go to Jesus. He had pointed the way to Jesus and said, it's not about me. I must diminish while he increases. And many of his disciples had gone and followed Jesus, but this group had not. And so they had stayed with John, but it's only now after his death that they go to their beloved leader, and they find Jesus. And it would seem that some of them at least will become disciples of Jesus going forward. Well, we'll bring the lesson to a close there again. As Herod now has this renewed interest in Jesus, that's going to cause Jesus now to leave and get out of Herod's jurisdiction, go across the Sea of Galilee, and we'll have the feeding of the 5,000 then that we'll look at next week. The life of Christ, what an interesting story. You know, Hollywood could never begin to write a script as interesting and as fulfilling as the gospel accounts tell us about Jesus Christ and the life that he lived. Lesson's yours. If anyone here this evening needs to respond to the Lord's invitation, if you would come as we stand and sing.